Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. We are delighted to have you here, and we thank you so much for supporting independent bookstores and for supporting our author events. It is such a great pleasure for me to introduce New York Times bestselling author and a really nice man, Christopher Bajalian. This book is set in 1943 in Tuscany, and then it moves ahead to 1955, so it's sort of a dual time storyline. And it's about the Rosati family and their beautiful villa in Tuscany, which has a necropolis, which are Etruscan tombs on site. And during World War II, the Nazis take over the villa. And why I like this book is because I've read lots of World War II novels, but I had never read one with the point of view from how the family feels and how they have to deal with the Nazis coming in and taking over, and not, you know, they have to sort of play along so they aren't killed or worse. Anyway, we forward to 1955, and the Rosati family members are being murdered. And so we meet Serafina Battini, a Florence police investigator, and she's called to the scene of the gruesome murder. And we find out that a lot of storylines are tied together, and it's, you know, Chris is a masterful storyteller. I will say that again and again. Like I said, Sandcastle Girls, Night Stranger, they were all my favorites. So please welcome Christopher Bajalian.
Thank you, Lisa, for that lovely introduction. It is a pleasure. It is an honor. It is a privilege to be back at one of the world's great independent bookstores, The Tattered Cover, for day 12 of The Light in the Ruins. Rock and roll. Get your t-shirts running, slime dog of literary capitalism book tour. Yes, I really do have t-shirts we will be giving away. The t-shirt cannons will be brought out in a few minutes, courtesy of Rodney, the store manager. Thank you, Rodney, very, very much. And Lisa, thank you for that lovely introduction. I want to thank all of you so much for coming out on this spectacularly beautiful Saturday night. You are the medieval monks of the digital age, because all of you still care about what words and reading and books can mean to the soul. So thank you. Now, I've shared with you before how incredibly glamorous my life is as a novelist on tour. It's not. Most people assume that you jet around the country and you hang around with Terry Gross and Oprah Winfrey and sell whole pallets of books. But the reality is that by day 17, you will have been on 19 regional jets and been reduced to wearing a strange man's underwear. I wish I could say I'm making that up. I'm not. When you are in the Tattered Cover, it's all good, but often getting here is fascinating. The reason why it's not as glamorous as you might expect is because a publisher wants to get you to as many cities as possible as quickly as possible, so you spend one night in every city. So Monday's New York, Tuesday's Boston, Wednesday Chicago, Thursday's Denver, Friday's San Francisco. One night, one city, one hotel. If you're a novelist on tour, there is nothing in the world you want more than two nights in a row in the same city, in the same hotel, for one reason and one reason only: laundry. You need that full day in a hotel to get your laundry taken care of. So here's what happened to me on the Secrets of Eden book tour. I've been on the road for 13 consecutive nights in 13 consecutive cities. When I arrive in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I get there at 4 in the afternoon, and I see I am not checking out until Sunday morning. So I'm happier than I've been in 2 weeks, and the first thing I do is I send out a Mini Cooper-sized pile of laundry. Do my Friday night event. Have two events on Saturday, one at lunchtime and one in the evening. Get back to my hotel Saturday night about 10:30, and there on the bed under plastic are all of my shirts, which have been cleaned, and a box with my laundry. Since I'm checking out Sunday morning, The first thing I do is I open my suitcase on the floor, and then I open that box on the bed, planning to move my laundry in one neat and tidy brick from the bed to the suitcase. So I open up the box on the bed, and in there are 13 pairs of underwear, not mine. Not a man's. They belonged to a very petite woman. Now, I've done this long enough that I know that rule number one of a book tour is this. You never give the hotel all of your underwear. Still have three pairs. We are not in crisis mode. So now Sunday morning, I am checking out, and I give these 13 pairs of women's underwear to the bellman, and the hotel laundry is closed, but it is going to open on Monday. So I say to the bellman, well, okay, when your laundry opens on Monday, if you find my underwear, here's the hotel in Orlando, Florida, where I'm going to be on Tuesday. And if you could send my laundry by Federal Express, I'd be grateful. And we both looked at each other like, yeah, that's going to happen. And then I checked out. Now, whenever you are on tour, to make it as civilized as possible for you, your publisher gives you an escort. Not that kind. These are wonderful women and men who, you know, they know where the bookstores are, the TV stations, the newspapers, and they get you to all of the places you have to get to. So, for example, here in Denver, it's the lovely and talented Lisa Maxson. Lisa, thank you very much for, you know, another great day. In Minneapolis, it's a guy named Tim Jennings. So Tim Jennings is going to bring me to the airport, and I get into his car, and I said to him, okay, any chance there's a store that's open between here and the airport on a Sunday morning where I can get some underwear? And he said two things to me that were kind of interesting. The first thing he said is this: wow, you're like the third author I've had this month who needs new underwear. And the second thing he said was this: yeah, there's a Boston's store, but you're going to have to move like lightning if you had any chance of getting on that plane. So we go to the Boston's department store. I race to the men's department. I get my underwear, and it's in a little brown Boston's bag, and then we get to the airport. No one flies through security as quickly as a novelist on a book tour. You throw the shoes, the laptop, the cell phone, and in this case, my Boston's bag of underwear on the conveyor belt, and you fly through the metal detector, and I do all of that. And I get to my gate to board my plane to Milwaukee, and I realize I no longer have my Boston's bag of men's underwear. How do I know this? I hear the following over the airport loudspeakers. Would the gentleman who left his underwear please return to security? It's bedlam at the gate. People go, oh my God, they're strip searching us. So I flew on to Milwaukee, had a lovely Sunday afternoon event in Milwaukee. Monday was delightful. I was in Ann Arbor. And then Tuesday, I flew on to Orlando, Florida. Get to my hotel about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the woman behind the counter says, Mr. Bojalian, I have a Federal Express package for you from Minneapolis. Son of a gun! It's from the hotel where I'd spent Friday and Saturday night. So as if it is my birthday, I cradle this Federal Express box against my chest and go racing up to my hotel room and open it up. And there in that box are 13 pairs of underwear, not mine. But they were a man's. And they were clean. And so I really did the last week of the Secrets of Eden book tour in a strange man's underwear and was grateful. Which, of course, brings us to my work, to our work together this evening, The Light in the Ruins. The Light in the Ruins actually had its origins in two moments in time on two continents. The first moment occurred a number of years ago when I was watching a production of West Side Story, Jerome Robbins and Leonard Bernstein's magnificent reimagining of Romeo and Juliet. And because my daughter, Grace Experience, was one of the shark girlfriends, I saw that production a lot. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with it not simply as a musical. I fell in love with it as a reimagining of Romeo and Juliet. I love stories of doomed lovers. I love stories of epic doomed lovers. And I knew that at some point I was going to write a novel based in some way on Romeo and Juliet. Didn't know where, didn't know when, but I squirreled the idea away in the back of my mind. A few years later, I was biking in Tuscany. I was biking with a friend of mine named Greg Levandusky, who lives there. And we went up one hill, and we're looking across the narrow valley at the next hilltop village. It's called Montisi. And Greg said to me, do you see the granary? And I knew the granary. It's a tower. It was built in the 14th century to rival the great tower in the Campo in Siena. And Greg said, it used to be about 15 feet higher. And I said, really? What happened? And he said, in 1944, the Nazis tried to blow it up. But they failed. They were only able to take off the top tip. Then he shrugged and said, man, we built things to last 600 years ago. Obviously, I knew that the Germans had been in Tuscany in World War II. But when we think of Tuscany, we don't think of the Nazis. We think of sun-drenched Italian villas. We think of Chianti. We think of sheep and pecorino cheese. We think of wonderful, magnificent villas with swimming pools and agriturismo. We think of under the Tuscan sun. That is what we think of. But the reality is that for 6 months in 1944, Tuscany was an innermost ring of Dante's Inferno. We liberated Rome in the first week of June, and the Nazis began their slow retreat up the Tuscan boot, scorching the earth. Partisan activity began in earnest with the Allies approaching, and so to dial down partisan activity, Adolf Hitler demanded that 6 Italians be executed for every German soldier who was killed behind the lines by partisans. So on any given day, 6, 12, 18, 36 Italian men, women, children, babies, priests would be lined up against the medieval ruins of Tuscany and machine gunned. Florence was a battleground. Every single bridge but one across the Arno was blown up. And it was a small civil war with the Italian black shirts, Mussolini's allies, fighting tooth and nail against the Italian partisans. For most Italians in 1944 in Tuscany, whether you were an aristocrat or a peasant, you were essentially the grass beneath the feet of battling elephants. And I knew I wanted to set my Romeo and Juliet in Tuscany in 1944. My Romeo, the ultimate forbidden love for an Italian nobleman's daughter, a 22-year-old German lieutenant named Friedrich. My Juliet, her name is Christina. She's 18 years old, and she lives in a magnificent villa. She lives there largely sheltered from the cataclysm of the war around her. Her older brothers are off in Sicily and in Florence, but she's living there with her older sister Francesca, her mother and father, and her nieces and nephews. And it is an idyllic existence sheltered from the war around her. And essentially, the book was going to chronicle the way the Rosati family's life unravels when Christina falls madly in love with Friedrich. And the book was going to be set entirely in 1943 and 1944, and that was going to be the story. I had a secondary character. Her name is Serafina. Her purpose, simply to be the antithesis of Christina. Her parents and her brothers have already been executed by the Nazis, and she's living in the woods of Mount Amietta as a partisan. I wrote a scene where she is horrifically burned in a firefight with the Nazis. Her right ear is literally burned off, the right side of her face, her neck, and much of her back are forever scarred. She nearly dies. But when she happens to live, I realized I really loved her as a character. And I wanted to spend more time with her. She became my Lisbeth Salander, my girl with the dragon tattoo. Deeply physically and emotionally scarred, but really interesting to me. So I began to wonder where she is after the war. And all of a sudden, the book was changed dramatically. Serafina, 10 years after the war, is the first woman in the Firenze Polizia, the first female homicide detective in Florence. And where does her paths cross in 1955 with Christina? When she's investigating the death of Christina's sister-in-law, Francesca. And increasingly, the death one by one by one of Christina's family. So the novel moves back and forth in time now, between the last year of the war in Tuscany and 1955. It's all third-person omniscient, except for a periodic first-person voice who appears in brief interludes. This is an individual with a profound grudge against the Rosatis. You're about to meet this particular individual. And the reason why I like this structure for the book, and I think you'll get a taste of it in these three brief passages I'm going to read, is it is about dread, an emotion that I think infiltrates my books when they work best. Midwives, the Sandcastle Girls, the Double Bind. They are about, among other emotions, dread. We know that horrific things are about to happen to characters we care about. And because it is about having a moral compass. In books like The Sandcastle Girls, Skeletons at the Feast, I'm probing what it means to make the right moral decision, to do the right thing. And all of the moral ambiguities that mark our world. As Francesca, Christina's sister-in-law, says to her, as Christina and her parents get more and more involved with the Germans and the Germans become more and more of a presence, welcomed into the Villa Chimera, the villa where Christina lives, Francesca says, you wait. We will pay for this. We will all pay. We are commingling with the cowardly angels. A reference to Dante. So, the first section I'm going to read is going to introduce you to that first-person voice that appears periodically. And this is how the book opens. A woman is sitting before an Art Nouveau vanity, brushing her hair in the mirror. It is, at least according to the police report, somewhere between midnight and 3 a.m. on the first Tuesday of June, 1955. For dinner, she ate a small portion of an impossibly rich pasta, a fettuccine with pecorino cheese and great ladles of truffle oil at a restaurant popular with wealthy American and British expatriates 5 blocks west of the Uffizi. She has since bathed, soaping off both her own perfume and the cologne that was worn by her dinner companion. The fellow who had come back to the apartment made love with her on the thin bed no more than 3 feet from the vanity and then left. He was a suspect in the murder investigation, but only briefly. If he had had even the slightest inclination to spend the evening, there's every chance that I would have executed him that night, too. At the moment, she's wearing her nightgown, which is not especially revealing, though at some point very soon it will be cut off of her. Yes, cut. Not even pulled over her head. Sliced from the opening at her collarbone down to the hem, which, when she stands, is mid-chin. By then, of course, she'll be dead, bleeding out. I will have sliced open her neck from one side of her jaw to the other. Just so you know that Art Nouveau vanity is not particularly valuable. The white paint is chipped, and two of the whip-like finials along the right side broke off years ago, before the war. Moreover, her nightgown is cotton, and the material has started to pill. I mentioned this so you are not envisioning this room as more glamorous than it was. The woman is still beautiful, even now at middle age and despite the horrific, seemingly unbearable losses she endured a decade ago in the last year of the war. These days, she lives in a neighborhood of Florence that is solidly working class, a section that tourists visit only when they are impressively, almost hopelessly lost. A decade ago, she would not have known a neighborhood like this even existed. The apartment has neither a doorman nor a primitive intercom connecting the wrought iron and frosted glass street door with her modest unit. It's locked, but not all that difficult to open. I moved silently up the stairway to the third floor where she lived and knocked on the door. She rose from the vanity, her brush still in her hand, and paused for a moment on her side of the wood. "Yes?" she asked. "Who is it?" And here I lied. I said I was her dinner companion, speaking into my gloved hand to muffle my voice. So she opened the door and would be dead within moments. And why did I slice open her nightgown? I didn't violate her. It was so I could cut out her heart and place it on the ashtray in the vanity. A woman with the lilting name of Francesco Rossati, who had once been a Tuscan Marchese's daughter-in-law, was my first, but, as you will see, not my last. Chapter 1, 1943. The planes flew in great flocks that May over the Crete Senese, the lunar-like landscape that marked the Tuscan countryside southeast of Siena. By night, the planes were British or American bombers, and their destination was Bologna. After that, they would attempt to reach Tunisia and reinforce the Axis troops there. But most, and Christina Rossati knew this from the BBC, not from her own country's newspapers, would be shot down and crash into the Mediterranean Sea. The Italians and Germans in North Africa were finished, and there was absolutely no chance of evacuating them. The army? It might as well have been on the moon. For a long moment, Christina stood outside on the villa's southern terrace and watched the planes, the dark fuselage of each aircraft gleaming in the sun. She was holding four cloth dolls that belonged to her young niece, as well as the scraps of red and gold napkins from which she was crafting Renaissance dresses for the two princesses and tunics for the two men, neither of whom, according to the little girl, was a prince. Christina had been playing with a child on the terrace when the girl's mother had informed them that it was nap time and herded the child and her brother upstairs to the nursery. And so Christina was alone when the planes droned southward high above the Villa Chimera. She was fascinated by them, held spellbound. Someday, when the world once again was at peace, she would fly somewhere in an airplane, to Pisa maybe, or Naples, or perhaps all the way to Paris. She couldn't imagine anything more glamorous than Paris. Now a pair of small lizards race past her, faster than snakes, darting just beyond her toes into the lilacs that grew along the edge of the loggia. Nearby, she heard the bells on the sheep end. Farther away, the low thrum of a distant tractor. Finally, when the planes had disappeared far to the south, she ventured inside. Her sister-in-law, Francesca, appeared almost at the same time, tiptoeing down the stairs so she wouldn't disturb her children. She was shaking her head. "I hate airplanes," Francesca said. "No good has come from an airplane, ever. You realize that, don't you?" Christina smiled. Francesca was fond of great, sweeping pronouncements. "You know that's not true." "I know nothing of the sort," Francesca said. "I saw you from the window. You were watching the airplanes. Someday, you'll be looking up, and they'll be bombing you, us, the estate. You watch. Someday, the bombs will be filling on our heads. Some days, our whole world will be ruins." And now I'm going to scoot ahead to introduce you briefly to Serafina, 1955. Serafina understood that her living arrangements were scandalous and would probably have shocked her family, but because her family had all been dead since 1943, she really didn't care. She had one of the two bedrooms in an apartment on the south side of the Arno with a beautiful view of the river and the hordes of tourists that had begun to crowd the Ponte Vecchio in search of bargains in silver and gold jewelry. Her roommate was an American banker named Milton, who was nearing 40, but still had a thick mop of magnificent red hair, cheekbones that most actors would have killed for, and a male lover, closer to Serafina's age than to his, who was a purser on the SS Transatlantic Cristoforo Colombo. Whenever the Cristoforo Colombo was docked in Italy and the purser came to Florence, Serafina would make herself scarce as a courtesy to the pair. Otherwise, however, she was content to serve as Milton's beard and live in an apartment and a neighborhood that were well beyond her means. Milton paid the lion's share of the rent, and most people, including the other detectives, presumed he was her lover. In reality, he was her best friend. Given the numbers of people he, too, had killed in the war, they shared a wistfulness and a rectitude and, when they really thought about it, a guilt that was rare in the cafes on that side of the river. In truth, Serafina had no idea whether her family would have been disappointed in her because they believed she was sleeping with a man out of wedlock or because she was sleeping with a man who was never going to marry her. The night after she had seen Francesco Rosati's heart sitting black and still in an ashtray and then had espresso with Christina, she got home well before Milton. She poured herself a glass of wine, got a pack of matches, and then thought about the Rosati family, as well as her own. Their families were demographically identical, or at least close to identical. Both she and Christina came from families of five, and they both had a pair of older brothers. In other words, the two of them had been the babies in their families, the youngest child and the only daughter. Christina, of course, still had a mother and a brother. Serafina? She had no one, and had had no one for nearly 12 years. Now, she sat in her high-collared blouse and skirt in an ornate wrought-iron chair on her and Milton's terrace, her bare feet on the balustrade over the river, and watched the sky grow dark and the light submerge over the river. She had most of her weight on her left side, as she did always when she reclined, careful to keep the back of the chair from pressing against the thick pink scars that spiraled like ornamental filigree from where her neck met her skull to her waist. It wasn't painful when anything pressed against them. Instead, she would experience a tingling around their edges and then a disconcerting numbness in their center. It was as if her back was hollow, which could all too quickly take her back to those long days of agony when she awoke, and there was little that anyone could do for the burns. They told her they had thought she would die. Among her first words in response, they said, was that she wished she had. Apparently, she had begged them to shoot her. Today, she hid both disfigurement and disability. Only Milton knew that she was unable to raise her right arm over her head, but he wasn't worried. He told her one evening, shrugging, that he never expected that her life would depend on her ability to shoot a bird from the sky. Now, she lit a match and let it burn for a moment before blowing it out. Then she pressed the still smoking tip hard against the skin on the inside of her thigh. She did this three times, tossing the three burned matches into the ashtray, and felt a little better when she was done. She recalled what Christina had told her as they were talking on the street outside that depressing little cafe near Francesca's apartment. At least they're all together now, meaning Francesca and her husband, their two children. This wasn't a clue in Serafina's opinion because it was evident that whoever had killed Francesca wasn't attempting to effect a heavenly reconciliation. Rather, it spoke to how far the Rosati family had fallen since they had lived in that magnificent villa. Behind her, she heard the apartment's front door open and recognized the sound of Milton's keys falling upon the glass-topped table in the entryway, and then his footsteps as he strolled through the living room to the terrace. He leaned over and kissed her on her cheek, and she could smell a vestigial trace of the sandalwood lotion he had rubbed on his face after shaving that morning. "So, any mayhem and madness today?" he asked her in Italian. "Or are the Florentines too done in by this heat to kill one another?" She looked up at him. "I saw a human heart."
"Where?"
"In an ashtray."
"That's disgusting."
"Oh, the rest of the body was far worse." He sat in the chair beside her, his elbows on his knees and his chin in his hands. "Is that a new suit?" she asked. It was a summer weight gray pinstripe, the lapels cut into deep, sharp triangles just below his collarbone.
"It is. Do you like it?"
"I do. Very, very much."
"Tell me all about your day," he said gently. "Clearly yours was far more grisly than mine."
"Thank you very, very much."
Thank you. And, you know, I must confess, when I was reading that section just now, and I don't read the same section at every library or bookstore I visit, but when I read that section tonight, it suddenly dawned on me, I need to give you a caveat. It's not all hearts in ashtrays. I mean, good housekeeping gave this book its seal of approval, calling, you know, a picturesque page turner. You know, People Magazine gave it this beautiful, lovely 4-star review, and, you know, it's been praised for its bewitching sensuality. So, just so you know, not all eviscerated Rosati's. Now, the first question is always the hardest for you and for me, so I want to give out a t-shirt for the first person who's brave enough to ask a question tonight. Wow. Holy cow. Thank you for being here.
Well, I have a question.
First of all, stand up.
Stand up.
You're going to wear this with pride. What's your name?
Tammy.
Tammy, great to see you again. This is the official Light in the Ruins, Rock and Roll, Beware the Chimera book tour t-shirt. And Tammy, come on down.
Oh, no.
Yes. You are so brave. Thank you. Now you can sit down and get your question. She's wearing that to work on Monday. Yes.
No, my question is I'm having to really go and kind of get a history lesson.
Do you want a history lesson on what was going on in Italy then?
I have been going to up and reading and then going to, you know, and looking up and Googling things.
Yeah.
How did you know all this?
Okay, Tammy's question is this.
Yeah.
Tammy's question is this. How did I know all of the history that marks this book? First of all, I love the research part of writing. I really do. One of the great gifts of being a novelist is the opportunity to ask strangers questions that are none of your business. And some of the history in this book is very, very, actually very easy to find. We all know pretty much what happened in Italy in World War II in terms of the military history. We know, obviously, that Rome is liberated the first week in June, Mussolini, I'm even go back in time. In 1943, in July, we invade and liberate Sicily. Mussolini's overthrown and imprisoned. The new Italian government vows its allegiance to Germany, but Germany doesn't believe for a minute that Italy is going to remain in the Pact of Steel. And in fact, by September, the Italians surrender to the Allies and the Germans are ready for it. And in fact, instantly occupy the boot and essentially make Italy, once an ally, now an occupied nation. And we know, you know, the history of the progression. The kind of history that it was really hard to figure out was this. What was it like to be a detective in Florence in 1955? That was really difficult. And I, you know, because we've all watched NCIS and, you know, every SUV or SVU there is. Someday there will be an SVU and an SUV. Tragically. You know, we know all of the procedures and how these things work, but I needed to make it right. I needed to make it authentic. And I was striking out because I speak just enough Italian to make sure that I don't order a boot with cheese in a restaurant in Italy and to get out of a gelateria with the right flavor of gelato. But I read no Italian. So I was striking out. But here's how you do it. I live in a village called Lincoln, Vermont. Not quite 1,000 people live there. The nearest store, other than the general store, is like 7 or 8 miles away. So, needing to understand how you're a Florence homicide detective would work in 1955, I walked across the street to the Lincoln General Store, where Krista Patterson Jones that day was the baker. Krista grew up in Lincoln. Krista Patterson Jones has a cousin named Chris Goodyear who was in the Navy. When Chris Goodyear was in the Navy, he was stationed in Naples. When he was stationed in Naples, he fell in love with Laura Renzi and married her. Laura Renzi has an uncle in Florence. Laura Renzi's uncle in Florence plays bocce with a retired Florence homicide detective. That's how you do the research. Thanks. Yes.
Yeah, did I,
Did I read any novels? I did. I mean, there are some just wonderful, wonderful novels set in Tuscany in the midst of World War II. Some of the ones that immediately, I'm going to tell you three books that immediately come to mind. First of all, here are the novels. Mary Doria Russell's A Thread of Grace. Such a beautiful, beautiful, powerful book about Northern Italy in World War II and the way so many Italians risked everything to protect Jewish citizens of Italy and Jewish citizens of Europe who had wound up in Northern Italy. Another great book, Restoration. Restoration is set in Tuscany. It was published 2 or 3 years ago, and it is about a Norwegian girl who is learning to restore paintings in Rome and winds up at a Tuscan estate in World War II hiding a very, very valuable painting. And then, of course, there's a memoir that is the first book that appears in my acknowledgments. It's by a British woman named Iris Origo. Iris Origo, in the late 1920s or early 1930s, married an Italian nobleman from Tuscany. And they created, out of the arid landscape, the Tuscany we think of today. They built a beautiful villa called La Foce with gardens and olive groves, vineyards, sunflowers, and they dramatically improved the quality of living of the tenant farmers on there. And in World War II, they were hiding British and American and French POWs as they escaped and worked their way south to the lines. It's a breathtaking memoir, War in Val d'Orcia. Yes. Sure.
The theme of this book had the fact that the Armenian genocide had occurred. Did this have any impact on you picking this particular theme of this book?
Sure. Did the Armenian genocide and the fact that my most recent book, Prior to the Light and the Ruins, The Sandcastle Girls, a love story set in the midst of the Armenian genocide, did that impact my decision to set a book in World War II? It didn't. The reverse is actually the case. In 1992, I tried for the first time to write a novel of the Armenian genocide. And I wrote the whole book, 392 manuscript pages. And when I finished reading it, I realized this novel was an utter train wreck. It worked on no levels. Moreover, about this time, Carol Edgardian published her remarkable novel of the Armenian genocide, Rise of the Euphrates. And I remember vividly thinking to myself, why in the name of heaven does anyone need my take on this story when we have the work of Carol Edgardian, Peter Balakian, and of course, Franz Werfel's magisterial epic of the genocide, The 40 Days of Musada. So I sent that manuscript to my alma mater, where my papers are archived. And if you're a scholar or a masochist, you can read that manuscript. I would discourage you. So the question, I think, is this. Why did I try again to write a novel of the Armenian genocide 18 years later? And there are a couple of reasons. First of all, because the story is so profoundly important. There's a direct link between the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, the Cambodian killing fields, Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur. It's a very, very long list. Secondly, while today most of North America could not find Aleppo, poor, tragic, cataclysmic Aleppo, once more in the news on a map, or places like Harpert, Bitlis, or Van. Once upon a time, all North American eyes were turned upon the fraying edges of the Ottoman Empire and looking on aghast. Between 1915 and 1917, the New York Times alone ran 154 articles about the Armenian genocide. But the news cycles moved on. There was the rise of Nazi Germany. There was the Great Depression. There was the new Ataturk government in 1924 that swept under the rug and began the systematic denial of what their predecessors had done. And what had their predecessors done? In 1915, there were 2 million Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire. By the end of the war, barely 500,000 would be alive. three out of every four systematically annihilated by their own government. Which brings me back to your question. In 1939, already the Armenian Genocide was so forgotten that on August 22nd, Adolf Hitler, prior to unleashing his panzers on Poland, wrote the following to his commanders. Be merciless. Be merciless. After all, who today remembers the annihilation of the Armenians? So, I think the Sandcastle Girls and that book that I wrote in 1992 in some ways was the forerunner of both Skeletons at the Feast in 2008 and The Light in the Ruins in 2013. It's a great question. Yes.
Did you go to Syria?
Did I go to Syria? Yeah. Did I go to Aleppo? Did I get to Deir Zor? Not once. Not twice. I had visas and plane reservations, and the State Department said no. Bad idea to go. So no. So I have traveled throughout the Middle East. I've been to Western Armenia. I've been to Armenia. But no, I have never been to Aleppo. I have never been to Deir Zor. Yes.
What were you originally going to do with Serafina before you decided to extend the book?
I love that question. What was I originally going to do with Serafina before I decided to extend the book? The morning I sat down to write this scene, and it's a very long scene, and it wound up on the cutting room floor. I do not have this scene in the book anymore. Now you just have flashbacks to what Serafina experienced with the firefight. I was going to kill her. She was going to die. You know how, of course, you know, Juliet dies. I sort of had this vision of, you know, Christina's going to die and Serafina's going to die. And but all of a sudden, Serafina's bravery really got to me. And I couldn't bring myself to kill her. So I have her being brought, and I'm not telling you where because it impacts the book. And she's alive. And I just realized, I want you to live. And I want you around. The world is a better... You know, remember what Hannibal Lecter says? The world is a better place when you're in... The world is a better place when Serafina's in it. So I let her live, but she was going to die. Anyway, in that scene where that brutal firefight is just, you know... There's a, I don't remember who said it. It might have been John Gardner. It might have been William Faulkner. They said, sometimes to make a book better, you got to kill your darlings. And as much as I love that scene of Serafina in the firefight, that was one of those darlings as a scene that I had to kill to make the rest of the book work. We'll go there and then there.
You had said that you were drawn to Serafina. Have you ever had a character in this book or any of them that you have a hard time developing, either because you don't like them?
Yeah.
Or just it's not coming to you. If that happens,
yeah.
Have
I ever written a character who I had a hard time getting into their head or growing to like them or just making them work, and so I cut them? Certainly I have. Worse, I've published books with characters in that like that, like, oh, every single woman in The Night Strangers. Yeah. I mean, I've written 16 books. I've written 17. I mean, you know, the book that you will see here at the Tattered Cover next summer, I'm in the home stretch of now. Here's the reality. I view kind of like what I do as being a pitcher, except at Coors Field. You go to the mound 30 times a year and hope that two-thirds of the time you succeed. I mean, if you go to the mound 30 or 32 times a year and you succeed two-thirds of the time, you're a 20-game winner. You are killing it. And I know that of my 16 books, some I'm really, really proud of. And some are utter train wrecks, even the ones that aren't just in the archives at Amherst. So, yeah, my books are filled with characters who don't work or with characters that I know in hindsight I could have made better if I were older or wiser or Ann Patchett. I saw a hand here, I think. Yes.
I'm just curious how long it took you to research this versus how long it takes you to write.
How long does it take me to research a book versus how long does it take me to write it? When I have an idea for a book, I usually spend somewhere, literally, like between 3 and 5 weeks. That's it. Immersing myself in the material to make sure that what I want to do is viable and I can learn what I need to learn. And then I research as I go along. I never have writer's block, and not simply because the quality bar is at my ankles. I rarely have writer's block, and when I do, it's because I haven't done my homework. It means I need to learn something more. So I'll give you a case in point. The Etruscan ruins are magnificent in reality. When you go to places like Cerveteri in Tuscany, they are beautiful and poignant and really, really interesting. But I knew nothing about the Etruscans when I started this book. So I read a little about them, but then I started interviewing and talking to people who might know the Etruscans. And one particular gentleman I knew, Philip Ambrose, is a classicist at the University of Vermont. And so much of what I was doing wasn't authentic enough, so he gave me a crash course in Etruscan pottery. What it was made, how it was made, how it was fired, what it really looked like. And this was great. Weirdly enough, he used to go to Montisi. He knew the village that was the basis for my novel. And so he said, "Have you talked to this woman and this woman and this guy?" And I said, no. And he put me in touch with them. And they were able to provide me all kinds of interesting minutiae about what the village was like in 1955, which elevated it when Serafina goes back there as part of her investigation into the murders. I want to give away a T-shirt. Who came really far to be here tonight? Okay, how far did you come?
260 miles. Indianapolis.
Okay, Indianapolis.
Western New York.
Western, okay. And what's your name?
Maureen.
Thank you for coming all the way from Western New York. And this is where we need the T-shirt. There we are. It's only 3 rows deep. I'm going to see if you can get it there with a T-shirt cannon. Oh, wait.
Armenia.
Okay. I want to give you both T-shirts. No. No.
Tigran, the chess master.
Monday morning, I'm wearing it to work.
I work with them, I'll hold them.
Okay.
For those of you listening on podcast, we just gave T-shirts to a reader who came to the tattered cover from Western New York and from Yerevan, Armenia. That is how great the tattered cover is. Yerevan is 8 time zones away. Thank you for being here. Wait, no, it's 10. It's 10 time zones. 11 time zones. Wow, 11. Okay, is there another question? Yes, sir.
The Seattle Times says, "Dead, solid, perfect. Wajalian is a literary novelist unafraid to reference Proust and Madeline and expect readers to get it." I don't get it.
This is a quote from a review of The Sandcastle Girls, and it's on the back of The Light in the Ruins. It is the Seattle Times, and it says, thank you, "Dead solid perfect. Bojalian is a literary novelist unafraid to reference Proust's Madeline and expect readers to get it." What that particular critic was referring to is, of course, Proust's wonderful, wonderful riff on the way that one Madeline Cookie brings back a raft of memories. And so in The Sandcastle Girls, I have a reference, and Laura Petrosian is talking about her childhood. And she's referring to something being, it's a Proustian Madeline from my childhood, meaning that this is something that instantly brings me back to when I was a kid. In this case, she's referring to her magnificent, loving grandparents' house, a house that her odar, or Swedish mother, has referred to as the Ottoman annex of the Metropolitan Museum of Art because it is filled with thick, beautiful, you know, oriental rugs, floor-to-ceiling bookcases with books in Armenian, and beautiful Armenian lace work on the furniture. Which is, incidentally, that was my grandparents'. That was the home of Levon Nazareth and Haigui Balkhchalian, my favorite home of any home I ever spent any time in as a boy, including the ones I grew up in. Okay, we're going to do two more questions. We'll go here and then here. Of all of my books that I have written, is there a character that I someday might bring back in a sequel? There are a few that I really care about deeply. The only times in my life I felt postpartum sadness when I finished a book and left behind characters were the following. The Sandcastle Girls, because I missed desperately Nivart, Hatun, Armin, Elizabeth. The Light in the Ruins, because of my Serafina. Midwives, because of Sybil. And The Double Bind, because of Laurel. I still worry about Laurel. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm ever going to do a sequel. I always worry that I can't recreate a magic moment in time like that. For example, I am hungry right now to write another novel of the Armenian experience. But I know in my heart I need to wait for the right story to come to me in the right moment, because The Sandcastle Girls was a once-in-a-lifetime reconnection to my ancestral DNA. That is one of those great gifts of the literary gods that comes but once in a lifetime. Likewise, when we left Laurel Esterbrook, we know where she is, if you've read the book. Where is she now? I don't know. Now, Serafina, I will tell you this. The book has only been out 2 weeks, and I have no fewer than 40 emails or Facebook messages or tweets from people saying they want a book two with Serafina. And, you know, they're already telling me lovingly, you know, what she should be doing next. And so, you know, it's entirely possible that maybe someday you'll see another Serafina. But the next book you will see here at the Tattered Cover, and you will see it July of 2014, is called Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. And it's the story of Emily Shepherd, a 16, then 17-year-old homeless girl in northern Vermont who's telling her story, trying desperately, horrifically, to keep it together with a 9-year-old runaway foster child sidekick in the wake of a Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant meltdown in northern New England that has left among the casualties and her an orphan, her mother and father. And it's called Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. We had a question here. The question is, do I want to tell you something about my next book? And I just, it says there. One last question. Yes.
So when our book club read The Double Bind, we paired it with The Great Gatsby, which is fabulous. Because that one has a very good classic reading background. And so when our book club read The Sandcastle Girls, I asked you for a pairing of some sort. And you recommended The Gendarme.
The Gendarme, sure. Okay. The question is this. And what's your name?
Lisa.
Lisa, great. Well, it's great to see you, Lisa. Lisa is from a book group, and when Lisa's book group read The Sandcastle Girls, they wanted to know about some books to pair it with, and one of the books I suggested was Mark T. Mustian's The Gendarme, which is another magnificent novel of the Armenian genocide. In this case, it's from the perspective of a Turkish gendarme, one of the killers one of the, you know, Ottoman, you know, soldiers who executed the Armenian genocide. So her question now is, what are some books to pair with The Light in the Ruins? Here are some that immediately come to mind. The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, another novel set north in the Tuscan Boot in the waning days of the Second World War. Again, Mary Doria Russell's A Thread of Grace, again set in northern Italy. And if you want to do a memoir and see the villa that was one of the villas that was instrumental in the creation of the Villa Chimera in The Light in the Ruins, read Iris Origo's memoir of her experience at La Foce in the Second World War, War in Val d'Orcia. So those are three books I would think about. I want to thank Lisa Casper, always has it going on, despite carpal tunnel right now. I want to thank Rodney managing the store tonight. I want to thank everyone with the tattered cover. And most of all, I want to thank all of you so much. I get to do what I get to do because of all of you. And I am grateful beyond words. And now happy to sign my books and Jody Pico's books and Alice Hoffman's books. Sorry, Jody. Sorry, Alice. Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.